Mad, Mark After Dark, the man that hates everything except the real thing. Coming to you once again, live on the air. Tonight on the program, drummer of Thin Lizzy, Brian Downey.
How did the musical styles change between the Black Eagles to Orphanage?
Well, the Black Eagles were just basically a covers band. We played all the top 20 hits of the time, you know, ranging from the Kinks to the Beatles to the Rolling Stones to the Kinks or the Herman's Hermits and all bands in between, you know. We did everything from the charts. And where the Orphanage is more of a sort of underground kind of a band, which incorporated a lot of West Coast of American tunes, you know, like some stuff from the Doors and the Birds and Jefferson Airplane and people like that. And Phil was also, at that stage, writing his own material and incorporating that stuff into the set as well, which was really interesting at the time because very few bands were doing that. And so that's where the Orphanage were at that stage. So, you know, it was a completely different band. And there was a couple of years in between where we kind of matured a little bit musically and everywhere else, you know. So, you know, there was no real comparison between the Black Eagles and the Orphanage, apart from, you know, maybe one or two tunes that we did, maybe some early Beatles and Stones stuff we did. But that was really it, because, I mean, you know, we were trying to sort of completely get away from that top 20 cover versions kind of a band into doing their own stuff, you know. And as I say, Phil was writing some great material even then. And so that was really the start of Phil's songwriting phase, because, I mean, before that, as I say, we were just doing stuff from the charts and, you know, album stuff. And, you know, when Phil started writing, he got this inspiration from a guy called Bruce Shields.
Yeah.
Who was, you know, he was playing in a band called Skid Row. And Phil had just left Skid Row when the album started. So he had a bit of experience in there writing songs with Bruce Shields. And he was adamant he wanted to do his own songwriting when he left Skid Row. So that was really the start of all that.
Okay. So, well, in between the Black Eagles and Orphanage, you joined a band called Sugar Shack. What did this band sound like?
Oh, yeah, well, the Sugar Shack was more of a straight-ahead blues band based on kind of the Paul Butterfield band and John Mayall's band and B.B. King and Buddy Guy and all those guys. You know, I got a call from a guy, a DJ here in Dublin, to say there was an opening for a drummer in the band called the Sugar Shack. You know, you should go down and maybe see how you get on. So I went down and another audition situation, and I went in there, and lucky enough, I knew most of the tunes these guys were playing, you know. And I did the audition and sailed through it again, and I got the gig. And we played lots of blues festivals and stuff here in Ireland, and we did some stuff in Northern Ireland as well. And we got a great opportunity to record a single. And there's a song called The Morning Jewel. It was written by Tim Rose.
Oh, yeah, I know the song.
You know the song. And we recorded that here in Dublin, and on the B-side was a Cream number called Sunshine of Your Love.
Oh, yeah.
But the record company wanted us to release The Morning Jewel, and that got into the charts here in Ireland. Got to number 16 here in the local charts here in Ireland.
Wow.
And that was a great opportunity to get lots of gigs. So we went out on the road, and you know, we did lots of tours and individual gigs all over the place. And that was a culmination of a whole year of playing, because we didn't last too long. We maybe lasted for maybe a year, maybe 14 months or something like that. And so when we broke up, I just happened to meet Phil on the street one day, and I said, "What, you know, what are you doing?" And he said, "Very little." And he said, "What are you doing?" I heard a Sugar Shack had broken up. And I said, "Yeah, you know." He said, "Well, let's get Sonny together." And that was the start of the Orphanage that we just mentioned a few minutes ago.
As a drummer, who are some of your heroes?
Oh, well, there's a lot of drummers I like from way back. I mean, you talk about Jimi Hendrix. I mean, Mitch Mitchell was a huge favorite of mine for years, and still is. And I love listening to Mitch. I suppose Ginger Baker would be another big influence, and, you know, people like Ainsley Dunbar.
Yeah.
Ainsley was a great drummer, still playing, as far as I know. All the guys that played on the Stax records, Al Jackson Jr. was a great favourite of mine. You know, people that played with B.B. King, all those drummers, Sonny Freeman's a huge, huge influence. Going back to the jazz guys, you know, Max Roach and Elvin Jones, Buddy Rich, all those guys are huge influences.
You and Phil met Eric Bell and organist Eric Rexon backstage after an Orphanage show, and it was suggested that the four of you form a band. Why were you not as excited about forming a band with Bell and Rexon as Phil was? Because
yeah.
I keep hearing
true.
That.
Yeah, that's true. I wasn't too excited because I think because of all the rehearsals and all the work we put into the Orphanage, we wanted to do as many gigs as possible. I mean, we were playing like four or five nights a week at that stage, you know, and money was coming in and it was pretty good because I wasn't used to making so much money at that stage. I was kind of doing manual labor, and when that band started, you know, it was a real opportunity to do some really good, make really good music, plus make some decent money for a change. And I just happened to move out of my mom's house a couple of months before that, and I got quite a lot of expenses to pay off, you know, rents and I had to feed myself and all the rest of it. So, you know, when it was suggested to me, it was like a flipping kind of, you know, let's try this down, you know, if you don't mind, and something might come out of that. I said, if that's the case, let's just keep the Orphanage together. What's the point of doing any rehearsals with Eric and Eric Rickson, you know? But when he sat me down and said, look, you know, I'm really serious about getting Eric Bell in. And I knew Eric had a great reputation as a really good guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really need to convince me too much. I said, of course, I rehearse with the guys, you know, no problem. And when we got down to rehearsing, we discovered that, yeah, you know, this is the way to go, you know. I'm not saying that he was a better guitar player than Joe Staunton, our previous guitar player, but what I'm saying is Eric Bell had a much bigger, wider influence. His musical knowledge was huge at the time, you know, and he had lots of experience playing with different bands, including Van Morrison.
Yeah, yeah, so, he was in them.
Yeah, you know, he had a lot of experience, and Eric Rickson as well, who's the keyboard player, yeah. He didn't really last too long in the band. But he played some great keyboards as well. So when the actual rehearsals happened, it just sounded really good to me. And after an hour of that, I said, yeah, let's break up the Orphanage. There's no problem there and reform with a new band, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And you know, it didn't really take us too long to get to know each other because, I mean, maybe it took a few days when everything really clicked into place and it seemed to really gel very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was very surprising. And then when Phil decided to put the suggestion out, you know, that most of the set was going to be originals, that was really, really fantastic news because we wanted to do something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil was again, he wanted to write most of the songs, and anybody else who was interested in writing could do so as well. So Eric Bell was writing a couple of tunes as well around that time.
Then Lizzie signed to Parlophone Records first in the summer of 70 and released the single The Farmer and I Need You on the B-side. Okay. Rexon left the band before the single's release. Were you surprised by his departure and were you surprised by the sales of that first single for being as low as it was?
Well, not really. I wasn't surprised. Now, the reason why Eric Rickson left because it was another economic decision where we discovered that, you know, as a four-piece, we weren't really making too much money in the early days of Thin Lizzy because of the fact that a lot of expenses went on really good PA systems and paying out money for vans and various other things where, you know, we needed a bigger PA system and bigger amplifiers and all the rest of it and bigger drum kit, of course, to make an impact. And our manager at the time suggested, look, he said, look, you know, we'd have to sort of pare this whole thing down, he reckoned. And he said, look, you know, we don't really need a keyboard player because half the time we can't hear the guy anyway with the volume on stage. And he's not really adding too much to the actual overall sound of the band. And And he suggested that maybe the guy should be let go, you know, Eric Gibson should be let go. Mm. And nobody was really too pleased about that, because, I mean, he was a really good friend of ours. And but when we discovered how much money we were losing on this particular project, we kind of had to say, look, you know, if it's not necessary in the band, he has to go, and it was left up to our manager to tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the band was really willing to suggest to Eric Gibson that he'd have to leave the band.
So the three of you moved into a house in Klondorf. Any good stories and recollections from those moments?
Well, yeah, you know, Klondorf was a famous house we had down there, where everybody seemed to come down after hours and came in to jam or listen to records or just hang out, you know. And most of them musicians like ourselves. And, you know, we had guys like Ditch Cassidy coming in there, and we had old friends like Joe Staunton and Pat Quigley and all sorts of people.
Okay.
And jam and just hang out and listen to music and just, you know, it was just a great time, you know, and that carefree attitude was happening around then as well. So there's lots of, you know, just parties all the time. Every night just seemed to be a party going on. So it's just a crazy place to live. And but I mean, the neighbours didn't really think too much of it. You know, sort of there's like lots of complaints. So we didn't really, we didn't last long. Maybe we were there for about a year or so. But it was a great time.
Well, after being dropped by Parlophone Records, Thin Lizzy were approached by Frank Rogers, like you said, of Decca. So by the end of 1970, the band were signed to Decca and traveled to London to record the debut album. What was it like recording for Decca as compared to Parlophone?
Well, you know, I mean, when we did Parlophone, Parlophone was like an Irish, well, it was a subsidiary company based in Ireland. And when we recorded The Farm, it was in a very makeshift studio. It was a very small place and a very sort of very basic equipment. And then, you know, when we got the deal with Decca, we were asked to go to London to record.
Mm-hmm.
And which meant, you know, upping sticks in Dublin and moving, going on the boat over to England. And when we got there, we discovered the studio was absolutely massive compared to where we recorded The Farm. This place is big, you know, it's a huge place and fantastic equipment. And I remember seeing this huge grand piano. It took up maybe one-fifth of the whole studio space. That just shows you how big the studio was. It was quite big. And we hooked up with a guy called Scott English, who's an American producer. And he was producing our record. And we discovered very quickly that, you know, this situation was very professional compared to what was happening back in Ireland. And so we used to get in there at 9 o'clock in the morning, which is like an unearthly hour for us to start recording. But we were in at 9 o'clock and finished around 10 o'clock in the evening.
Wow.
So it was quite a long session. We did this session like 9 o'clock to 10 at night for like 5 days or 6 days in a row just to get the whole album down. And it worked out really well because, I mean, there was no weird hitches as such, you know, everything went very smoothly. And we had, like, you know, we had the whole album done in 5 or 6 days.
Wow.
And then we were asked to go back to Ireland without mixing it, and we weren't allowed to mix it, but that was left up to Scott English and another guy, who I can't remember offhand at the minute, but...
That's okay.
His name will come to me, but... We were just asked to go back to Ireland and not have anything to do with the mix, so that was left up to Scott and this other engineer to mix, and you know, and then we got the final results about maybe 6 or 8 weeks later. A cassette tape was sent to us, and we were asked to say, you know, what you think of the mix, and you know, obviously you have to say, yeah, we loved it. We had no option, you know, you have to say, yeah, it was great. And actually, it did turn out quite well in the end. You know, there's no problem with it. And you know, it was released in 1971, and
mm-hmm.
it really didn't do too much because we were traveling around. We were actually based in England at this stage. We decided to move to England to base ourselves there. And we were going up and down the English motorways to different gigs. And next of all, we were listening to Radio Luxembourg one night. And this guy called Kit Jensen, who was a DJ.
Yeah, he was playing.
He picked up on this record and started playing it. And every night after gigs, we were listening to his show. And his show was about two hours long. And he played Thin Lizzy every night for about 6 to 8 weeks. And the album got a lot of airplay and a lot of critical acclaim, but never really sold many copies.
A song off the debut album called The Clifton Grange Hotel, which was an actual establishment run by Phil's mother in Manchester. Do you have any special recollections from that place?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first time we went to England, any time we played around Manchester, where the Clifton Grange Hotel was situated, Phyllis used to invite us back and put us up for free, you know. So any opportunity we could get, we could try, you know, we tried to get back to Manchester to her hotel to stay there, because I mean, it was just a fantastic place. I mean, she had this bar that opened till 6 or 7 in the morning, and all the showbiz people in the north of England used to come around and stay there for a few drinks and maybe stay overnight, you know. So you'd have lots of famous people sitting in the bar there at all hours in the morning, and lots of bands that was around at the time as well, you know, there's various underground bands like the Bones of Dog, Doodah Band, and people like that, and all sorts of comedians and showbiz people in general used to stay there. So it was a real mishmash of all kinds of weird people. You know, it was just a great place to stay, and our food was just fantastic. She used to make up this fantastic huge breakfast in the morning, you know. You know, you could barely eat it with so much food there. And, we just loved staying there. Anytime we stayed, we're in close proximity of the Clifton Grange Hotel. We made sure we'd stay there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Phyllis made sure we did as well, because she used to come to any of the gigs we played, and she like forced you to go back anyway, even if you didn't want to go back. You know? But it was just a great place to stay, and just a great hotel generally, you know.
Okay. Both the album and the title track of the second album, Shades of a Blue Orphanage, refer to earlier bands that Phil and you had been in, and Eric's band Shades of Blue. Did this title reflect the merging of styles?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, Eric Bell's band, Shades of Blue, were like, I suppose, a bit like a Sugar Shack, more like a bluesy kind of, you know, band with a bit of, you know, a little bit of songwriting as well in there. So I suppose you're right, it would be an amalgamation of all those three bands.
Yeah,
and the styles were all amalgamated, I'm sure you're right. But I think the real idea, I mean, for Shades of Blue Orphanage, as you said, it was really nothing to do with the actual tunes on the record, because, I mean, I've never heard Eric's band. I've never heard him live. In fact, I've never heard him at all. I don't think there's any recordings of Shades of Blue. So I wasn't really too well up on what Eric was playing, apart from his show band work with the James Show Band, and his stuff with Van Morrison. But, you know, I think Phil just came out with this, you know, let's call it Shades of Blue, and the references was obviously Shades of the Orphanage, Shades of Blue Orphanage, obviously, and Shades of Blue, which was Eric's band, but nothing to do with the Sugar Shack or any of the previous bands.
Oh, yeah, I figured it had something to do with Orphanage and his old band.
Oh, it was definitely just Orphanage and Shades of Blue,
definitely.
You know, so, but I don't think musically had really much relevance, you know. It's just the two names, really, you know.
Well, on the big 72 Slade tour, Thin Lizzy opened the show and were criticized for not exciting the audience by Slade and former Hendrix manager Chas Chandler. Chandler also threatened to kick Lizzy off the tour. Were you impressed by Phil's approach to making the adjustments, and do you have any recollections of that tour?
Yeah, I do have recollections. I can't understand why Chas criticized the band so much, because, you know, really, we were trying our best. I mean, there was no reason why you should have said that, apart from maybe one gig where Phil came down with a heavy cold, and this particular cold obviously put him out of sorts, because he was struggling to get his breath in most of the tunes, because he had a touch of asthma as well, Phil, you know. So when he came down with this cold, I think that was the night Chaz actually saw the band.
Wow.
And criticized the band, not knowing exactly what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But if he saw the rest of the gigs, he wouldn't have said that, because Phil was just jumping around all over the stage, including Eric Bell. And there was absolutely no reason why that criticism was just, because he obviously came down on the wrong night. Apart from that, I think when we played with Slade, we were really relatively unknown. You know, nobody in England knew who the hell Thin Lizzy was. And we were third on the bill. Susie Quattro was second on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a really bad spot, but nobody knew who the hell we were. And our music was a little bit strange, because, I mean, Slade were kind of a glam rock band who had, like, lots of hits in the UK charts, and, you know, they were very, very popular. We were kind of an unheard band. Whiskey in the Jar wasn't released yet, and
mm-hmm.
we were kind of struggling and, you know, doing our best, but not going down badly, considering that we were a totally unheard of band. I think we went down quite well in that tour, you know. Susie Quattro even said that one interview I remember reading, that she reckoned that Thin Lizzy went down maybe better than Susie Quattro did, you know, so that was great. But I think just Chaz just seemed to happen to see us on the wrong night, you know.
Yeah,
nothing we could do about that, because, as I say, Phil had a really bad heavy cold that night.
Yeah, that must have really upset Phil, because he was manager for his hero.
Well, it did, you know, because, I mean, Hendrix was, like, as you say, a huge hero,
mm-hmm.
and Chaz so happened to manage Hendrix, and, you know, Phil was a bit taken aback with the whole thing. He said, "Look, what's going on here?" I mean, I just said, "Look, you cut us on that particular bad night," and we all just said, "Well, there's nothing we can do about that. Let's just carry on and forget about it." And that's what we did, you know. So I don't think we even met Chaz Chandler after that particular tour. I don't think we ever met him again, you know.
Yeah. In mid-72, Thin Lizzy were asked to record an album of Deep Purple covers alongside members of another band, Elmer Fudd, entitled Funky Junction Plays a Tribute to Deep Purple. The album was released in January 73. How did this come to be, and was the band fans of Deep Purple?
Well, no, we weren't fans, but what happened was Ritchie Blackmore happened to hear our first album, and obviously liked what he heard, and saw Phil, I think it was in the Speakeasy Club in London, and we just went up to Phil and said, "Look, man, you know," he says, "I really like your first album, man. I'm thinking of doing some stuff independent of Deep Purple, you know, would you be interested maybe in coming in and maybe doing something with me?" And Phil said, "Yeah, of course I will, you know, that's great, you know." But I think what happened was, when they actually got together to do some tracks, Ritchie Blackmore asked him to join a new band. And I think Phil kind of balked a little bit at that. He wasn't too sure whether he should, you know. And when he came back to Eric and me, and he just said, "You know, look, I've been offered to form a band with Ritchie Blackmore, but I'm not really sure. I don't think I should, you know." And I just went, "Maybe you shouldn't." You know, and I think Eric Boyle said something similar, so it just went, "Yeah, well, I was thinking about it for 5 minutes." And but I mean, you know, Richard Blackmore came down when we were doing Shades of a Blue Orphanage. He came down to the studio and with his guitar and just plugged in and started jamming with us in the studio. And
wow.
I think he was going to turn around then and said, "Look, guys, you know, I'm thinking of forming a band, and why don't you all play with me, not just Phil?"
Mm-hmm.
But he never did, unfortunately. But I don't think you know, he would have said, "I'm just joking." But I mean, I think Phil, you know, certainly given the opportunity to do it, you know. But getting back to the actual album, then, the album Funky Junction was one of these albums that was we were asked to do it because it was a tribute to Deep Purple. We needed the money. The guy who was staying with Phil at the time was a recording engineer called Des Okoko, and he was staying with Phil in the same house, and he just happened to say to Phil one night, "Look, I'm going to do a tribute album to Deep Purple. Are you interested in playing on it?" And Phil goes, "Yeah, well, who do you need?" He said, "Well, I need a drummer, guitar player, you on bass." He said, "Well, why don't you use the rest of the guys in the band, you know, Brian Young and Eric Bell?" And the guy goes, "Well, great."
Yeah.
So we all headed down to his studio, and we got these two guys from Elmer Fudd, a guy called Benny White, and another guy called Dave Lennox from keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically knew the Deep Purple tunes because these are tunes that were really well known in the heavy metal circles in the UK and in Ireland as well. And everybody knew Deep Purple's first album in rock and the first album, Book of Teletime. So we were quite familiar with their music. And there's absolutely no problem to go in there and play these tunes in the studio. And that's what we did with Benny White singing vocals and Dave Lennox and keyboards. And we knocked it out in a couple of days. There's absolutely no problem doing these tracks. And also there's a couple of tunes in there that were, you know, obviously put in for fillers with Eric Bell coming up with a version of Shenandoah, Go Lassie Go was another kind of a thing. And there was another couple of tunes which I can't remember I found, which had nothing to do with Deep Purple, but we just decided to record them and put it out as a tribute to Deep Purple. And again, you know, nobody realised that it was going to be one of these albums 20 years later. Everybody's going to pick up on it, you know, and say, "Oh, Christ, no, it's a Thin Lizzy album." you know, and everybody went out and bought it, but it didn't really sell too many copies, you know. It's a kind of a collector's item now.
Well, on November 3rd, 1972, Whiskey in the Jar and Black Boys on the Corner on the B-side was released as a single. Did you agree with Phil that Black Boys on the Corner should have been the A-side?
Yeah, I did. You know, it sounds funny now, but we all did. You know, we thought it was a great song.
It is.
You know? Yeah.
I love that song.
It shows you how sort of far off the market could be. But anyway, when we decided to record it, I mean, we went into the studio and we had great sort of expectations for this particular tune. And our manager came in and said, yeah, you know, it sounds great. Let's put Whiskey in the Jar on the B-side. I mean, we recorded Whiskey in the Jar without any problems and went up to the record company with the two tunes and they rejected the A-side. Completely, you know, no problem. Look, guys, we don't want that. We want the B-side. And we went, what? You're not serious. And, you know, and it was either that or we don't release it at all. And we had to obviously comply with their wishes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was just flipped around. So Whiskey in the Jar became the A-side and Black Boys in the Corner became the B-side. And we were all kind of, you know, going, you know, this is crazy. Why are you doing this? And can you not see that Black Boys is a fantastic commercial tune? And, you know, we were a little bit upset about it. And, you know, but then when it came out and lots of DJs on the radio started picking up on it again. And it was one of these, like, slow burners. It was like a sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
Everything could take ages to take off. And, you know, we were doing gigs around the country and people were coming up and saying, where can we get this record called Whiskey in the Jar? And we were going, oh, you know, you just go down to your local record shop and order it and whatever, you know. And it took a while for it to sink in that I think that the record company would be a bit slow to get these singles out of the record shops. But eventually, after a couple of months, it started taking off and eventually going to the charts. And I think, you know, going back again to the Slade Tour, I think the Slade Tour really helped, you know, break that single as well, because people who saw us on that tour obviously, we're familiar with the name, and we were playing Whiskey in the Jar in that particular tour as well. So
wow.
They kind of had an idea of what this song was all about, you know. So, but again, it seemed to take a long time to really, you know, sell a lot of copies, and eventually it ended up at number six in the UK charts, and it got to number one here in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the start of lots of extensive touring, you know. I'm talking about, you know, going six nights a week for maybe 10 months of the year. It was just one of these songs that, you know, just really put us on the map in the UK. And we were just constantly touring with different bands and just touring on our own as well and playing all sorts of independent club gigs as well, you know. So it was just a brilliant opportunity to go out there and just, you know, make sure, you know, we weren't going to make any mistakes, you know, we were going to sort of keep going. And and then, you know, with the album coming out as well, which was Vagabonds of the Western World, you know, that really gave us lots of confidence to go in there and make sure we did a good album. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the album really, looking back, it really didn't sell that well, considering that, you know, we had a hit single with Whiskey in the Jar. We just sort of thought maybe, you know, when we get the album out, that would sell equally as well, but it didn't, unfortunately. It did better than the previous two albums.
Yeah,
but it didn't do all that good, really, you know.
It was a great album. Vagabonds is probably the best of the three, I think.
Yeah, it was a really great album, and everybody was really totally surprised that it didn't do as well as it did.
Well,
and I just think it was a little bit, maybe a little bit too progressive for the commercial taste that were sort of, you know, obviously people who were buying Whiskey in the Jar, you know, it was a very commercial song.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it just went over their heads a little bit. Could have been a little bit too progressive, you know, for the time.
Okay, well, in 1973, you wrote a song called Sitamoya. What inspired you to write that song?
Well, Sitamoya is an Irish chant that came from a Gaelic. It's kind of a Gaelic tune that we learnt in school.
Mm-hmm.
This particular Sitamoya was mispronounced by Phil and everybody else because we couldn't grasp Gaelic, and I still can't grasp it. It was a very, very difficult language to learn.
Yeah.
But in school, we were given the basics of this particular language, and I just love listening to it. It's just a very musical language. And this particular song, Sitamoya, came from that particular time when we were in school, and Phil... The melody is very similar to this old traditional song as well, but Phil made up his own phonetic version of this particular Gaelic song, you know, and that's where Sitamoya came from. And somebody said, you know, to me only recently, he said, if you want me to translate the original one for you, I will, into English. But he hasn't got back to me, and I'm still waiting for this particular translation. And... But, you know, it was just basically taken from a traditional Irish chant.
Oh.
And I put drums, I put 6/8 drums to it. It's in 6/8 time, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil put up just a fantastic melody over it. He wrote this tune on the bass. And the melody was just great, you know. It was a little bit like the traditional version, but he put his own little slant on it to make it, you know, more up to date, and then he put the English words in as well, which made the song, you know. But you know, and it was one of my favorite early Thin Lizzy songs, and still is, you know.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and that was kind of a taste of what came later with songs like Emerald and other Irish kind of influenced songs as well,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I think Sitamoya started that trend off within the band.
Okay. Well, like we were saying, in the fall of 73, Thin Lizzy's third album, Vagabonds of the Western World, had come out. The second track, Hero and the Madman, which we had talked about, featured radio personality Kid Jensen on it. How did this come to be, and what is that song about? I never was able to figure out what that song is totally about.
Well, you know, I'm as much in the dark as you are. I'm not really sure what the song is about either. But the reason Kid Jensen spoke on it is because we got to know Kid very, very well, and he became a really good friend of ours. He invited us out to his studio in Luxembourg to do various interviews on his radio show. And we stayed in the hotel around the corner from where he lived, and we became really good friends. And you know, I mean, Kid Jensen was like a big DJ back in Radio Luxembourg in those days, and you know, he was really a huge fan of the band, and he had a fantastic speaking voice. You know, he had a really good he was a Canadian guy, and he had a lovely voice and lovely accent. And Phil said, you know, I want to get Kid in. And nobody objected. We all loved Kid. And his voice just comes across really great on that particular song. And, you know, when he came over, you know, he listened to the song back and he said, I know where I want to put that voiceover. And Phil said, yeah, that's the place I wanted you to do it as well. That's amazing. So when he came in, he did it in a couple of takes and there's no problem. And it sounded to me, you know, it really made that tune, you know. here in the Madman. But what that song is about, I don't know. I mean, it's really one of those, you can take your own meaning out of it if you want. You know, it's one of those kind of songs.
Yeah. On the Irish Christmas Tour 73, You Hurt Your Right Hand, and drummer Pierce Kelly joined in doing all the fills. What are your recollections of that experience?
Yeah, that was actually true. What happened there was I was playing so hard within the band and playing too many gigs, and I just happened to develop a bad blister on my left middle finger.
Mm-hmm.
And I just let it go again, a case of not taking care of it, and it just got really, really bad. One night, I just could not sleep with just the pain. I got up about 1 o'clock in the morning and decided to go straight to the hospital. I was living in London at this stage, and I went to the Tottenham Hospital in North London. And when the nurse took one look at it, she said, well, you need to go into surgery straight away. And I said, what? She said, it's infected, you know, you never know what you might get. You could get gangrene or something. So I said, well, you know, that's weird. And she said, I bet she's paining me. I said, sure it is, really, really sore. And she said, hang on a couple of minutes, I'll find a surgeon. And so I was waiting there for maybe 25 minutes, and this surgeon came out with a scalpel, and he said, yeah, you know, I'm going to give you a local anesthetic here, and it's going to pain you. It's going to be painful for a few minutes, and then it'll numb up a bit. So I was in hospital there at 2 o'clock in the morning getting my my middle finger lanced, you know, to get all this pus out of it. It was really bad.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was really, really so painful. But that put me out of action for a couple of months. So when I obviously had to tell management and everybody else, so when they heard about this, there's a couple of gigs cancelled because of it. And then I just said, well, look, you know, don't cancel the gigs. Let's get somebody in. I'll go on drums and play with my right hand and get Pierce Kelly, who was a friend of ours from the Gary Moore Band. Mm-hmm. I said, look, I'll call Liam Kelly and ask him, will he do the rest of the gigs? And I called him up and said, yeah, no problem. There was nothing happening to the Gary Moore Band. And he came in and finished off the whole tour, which was like maybe 15 dates to go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two drum kits on the stage set up right beside each other, and I was playing with my right hand just to keep the beat, and Pierce was playing all the fills and all the cymbal crashes and everything else he could think of, and you know, and it sounded okay, and a lot of people never actually realised that I wasn't playing with my left hand, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that amazing, because it just shows you how much people take an interest in the drummers, because a few people came up and said, well, what's the idea of these two drummers? And I went, well, can you not see? I'm all bandaged up here. I said, oh, shit, yeah, you know. So, but that was just one of those things. I couldn't cancel the tour, and I didn't particularly want to cancel.
Mm-hmm.
So we just decided to get Pierce in, and it was great, and it was really... In fact, I think at the end of the day, Pierce was quite upset that he had to leave, because he was enjoying it so much.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things. But no, my finger really was pretty bad at the time, you know.
Okay. On New Year's Eve 1973, Eric Bell suddenly left the band and was replaced by Gary Moore to help finish the tour. What was the differences between Gary Moore to Eric Bell playing in the band at that point, and how would you compare working with Bell to Moore and recording with him?
Yeah, well, the funny thing about Eric Bell leaving was it was a very unusual night, because it was New Year's Eve and it was a gig in Belfast, Eric Bell's hometown, and he just happened to meet up with some friends he hadn't seen in maybe 5 or 6 years, and because we were all living out of Ireland at that stage, and when he met up with them on New Year's, he just happened to get too drunk. He just happened to have too many drinks over a period of a couple of hours, and we had to play that gig that night, you know, we had to play. And when Eric came down to the sound check, he coupled too many. So we all said, you know, well, you know, the best thing to do, Eric, is get a couple of cups of coffee in you there and try and sober up, and which he did. But again, like just before the gig started, a couple of people came into the dressing room and presented to Eric Bell with a bottle of whiskey, which he proceeded to drink with his friends. And that set him off again. So when we got on the stage to play the gig, he was well over the limit, you know, he was well drunk. And he didn't particularly want to play that particular night because, he was so drunk he couldn't hit the notes. And even though I didn't think it was that bad, he just said, look, you turned around to Fellamine and, you know, I've had it. And this was halfway through the actual set. And he took his guitar off and threw it on the floor and just walked off the stage.
Wow.
Which left me and Phil to actually play the rest of the gig as a two-piece band.
That must have sounded very
really
interesting.
Hard to do, you know, bass and drums finishing off the gig, you know. But we did. And unfortunately, Eric didn't come back on stage. So we just finished off the gig and went back to the dressing room. And Phil was furious, you know, he just lost it completely where Eric and said, look, you know, that's the case, and well, it'd be better off to leave, you know, if you're not going to finish off gigs or, you know, if you're going to throw your guitar down on the stage and walk off, what's the point of playing?
Mm-hmm.
So Eric just, he said, yeah, well, you know, that's the case, so I will leave. So we left that night, but we had 6 or 7 dates to finish in Ireland. And we had no guitar player to finish them off. So Phil, the next morning, got straight on the phone to our manager, Chris Morrison, and said to Chris, he said, look, we need to get a guitar player in here. Why don't we phone Gary Moore and try and get him over to finish off the tour? Because I'm not prepared to work with Eric. You know, he's so unreliable after last night. I wouldn't feel confident going on with Eric. But I had a slightly different take on it. I was willing to see where, you know, see Eric's problems and to finish off the tour with Eric. But I mean, after having said it to Phil, it was just, there was no argument with Phil, he just didn't want to know. And when he was on the phone to Chris Morrison, I tried to ask Chris Morrison to talk to Eric, but even Phil wasn't having that. So, I mean, there was no point in me arguing the toss with Phil. He just wanted somebody else in to finish the tour. So Gary Moore was contacted by Chris Morrison and lucky enough, Gary had nothing to do that particular couple of weeks. So he came over and had a very brief rehearsal the next day. I think we cancelled two shows, or rescheduled two shows. And we just picked up where we left off with Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was a different set because obviously Gary didn't know some of the tunes. So we sort of basically jammed on blues numbers that we knew from the early days when we used to jam with Skid Row and Gary Moore. So, you know, that particular finish of that tour was just a jamming session with Gary Moore, and there was no real structure to the set. But we have to do it because we have to finish the tour, you know. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
we would have been in people would have been suing us and all sorts of shit, you know.
Yeah.
So we had no option. We just had to do it. But it was really nice because I mean, Gary is so good on guitar. We had absolutely no problem playing with the guy.